Hello and welcome to the Yay Yoga podcast. I'm Renee Liu. You may know me as a yoga teacher, and today I'm the host of this podcast where I talk to the most inspiring teachers from around the world about their yoga journey. My guest today is David Kam, a London-based teacher of a practice that is best described as a fusion of yoga, dance, and animal flow. His work is about playing and exploring, and in today's episode he will explain why it's so important to play and change things up as adults. We also talk about embodiment and the use of language as a teacher, and how growing up in Malaysia taught David the art of fusion. The link to the show notes will be in the description of this episode, and I'd love to hear what you got out of this conversation, so please share and enjoy listening. Welcome to the Yay Yoga podcast, David. So happy that you could make the time to have this conversation. Just before we start, how are you feeling today? And obviously it's a new year, so do you work with any New Year's resolutions, and do you want to share them maybe?
2021 has been quite a good start so far. I feel a very clear shift towards action after a year of just really deep rest. I wasn't up to much at all last year, just to take everything in, because it is, you know, huge changes across the world. And I enter this year feeling a little bit more like, you know what, there's a sense of familiarity here. And although things are still taking time to go back to how it used to be, well, it never really will. But as we transition towards better times, I'm seeing myself step up a little bit more, you know, and offer a little bit more, share a little bit more of what I've learned over the past year. So I guess an intention that I have for this year is to really take a moment to notice the little things in between, and, you know, the little moments that keep me joyful, and to really treasure that, because I feel that's something that can be such an anchor for us all. Yeah,
that's beautiful. What have you learned over the last year by taking it slow and maybe reflecting more than you usually did?
I feel the biggest lesson is my intention, which I stated just now, which is the little things that bring me contentment. Because as devastating as last year is as a whole, it is one year that I felt most content in a long time. You know, like the past few years have been so eventful. There's been so many personal, professional highlights, but yet last year was the one year that I felt most content. So why was that? And the only thing that has really changed is me having the time to really pause, even not by choice, you know, because we are all forced to kind of be within, you know, the four walls of our shelter. And with that, you are stripped away from many choices and you're brought back into the absolute essential of your everyday. And then you really recognize these simple things that are around you that is actually more than enough. And where I am right now, I'm in London, and I am witnessing a lot of my friends and colleagues coming into places of awareness where they're starting to move away from London and into, you know, a quieter place as well, having come to the same realization. So yeah, I think that is definitely the biggest lesson I've learned, like that all that we wish for is always within reach. There's nothing really out there that you need to attain to be a better you. Is down to the realization and opening up your eyes to the things around you, so that you can come into your best self and your grateful self.
Yeah, that's beautiful. I love how we're already starting this conversation with with a very sensible topic, and I'm pretty sure that we will continue this wave during our conversation. But just before we dive in, can you maybe tell our listeners a bit about what you are doing, what you're working on currently, maybe?
Mm-hmm. So, my name is David Kam, and I'm really honored to be on this podcast. It's always nice to meet new communities, and especially on the listening sphere. My work mainly lies within the intersections of play, inclusivity, and well-being, and the threat through it all being movement. My background is within architecture and dance performance before I transitioned into yoga. And one of my biggest spark or my biggest question is how we can allow the pursuit of wellness to be something that is deeply personal. Because what I've been witnessing a lot is prescriptive solutions, and I find myself falling into this a lot, right? Like follow these steps to achieve this or that, do these few things to feel a certain way. But the truth is, after having taught for so many years and going through my personal experiences, we all experience different things. And the best way to be is to really allow ourselves to play with that uncertainty and to not allow ourselves to be defined by what is suggested out there. And this is where play comes in. I simply wish to offer spaces where we can just play with the possibilities of how we might be able to act, to think differently, and see what that brings to our body so that we can build this personal intelligence within ourselves. And the hope of that is so that we can be responsive, because the one thing we know for sure is that there'll always be change. And like, I can teach you to be, you know, someone who is the absolute best in this specific thing, but then come 5 years down the line, 10 years down the line, it may all be inapplicable or not relevant. But what we can do is to build how we can be so attentive and present to what is right now that we can then adapt our bodies and minds towards serving where we need to be. So yeah, I guess that's my work. I hope that answered the question.
Yes, for sure. And one question that I ask to all my guests here is, what does yoga mean to you? And I'm very curious to hear what it means to you, because your style of teaching is not according to a traditional yoga style. And so I've listened to some interviews with you where you already mentioned that some people state that your classes are not yoga, right? So I'm curious to hear what yoga means to you.
Yoga for me at the moment, it means freedom, it means liberation, because of that, I feel it's very highly contextual over times. And a big part of the way I share yoga, which sometimes can be challenged as not yoga, is because of my personal context. You know, me having been living in London, and London being such a huge yoga scene, I have yogis coming into class knowing the posture sometimes better than I do, you know, and because of that, where does the physical practice progress towards when the bodies that I see in front of me are already, you know, so comfortably in these sacred shapes that has been introduced to us for a long time now. And then to really look into, you know, what yoga means and what asana means specifically when it comes to how we teach, right? We mainly teach asana within a class. What is it for? It's to prepare for us towards the seat of meditation. And I would like to see meditation within this context again, not necessarily as I'm going to sit down and meditate, but a state of mind. A state of mind where you feel that you are perhaps at peace, or where you're in flow, somewhere where you feel bliss. And this could be like a millisecond, right, or a really long time. That's your experience. But how can we use movement to prepare ourselves towards being within the seat of that state of mind? And I am seeing in my classes that, all right, these students know these postures so well, but yet I'm noticing distraction within their minds. So in my observation, they've not really been practicing the intention of yoga, which is towards finding that place of meditation. So how do we get them there? And what I find really helping is just by presenting challenges, by pushing them out of the norm. So I'd like to share another definition of yoga, which I've been holding on to for a long time before, how it represents freedom to me right now. And this is actually a definition, I believe, by Jason Crandell, who is a really renowned teacher. And he's, I guess his way of teaching is very different to me, but I really respect that. He's an alignment-based teacher. And his definition is that the practice of yoga is to share the light of awareness into the darkest corners of their bodies and minds. So where you are not aware of, bring your awareness there. So with these people that are turning up to class within London, within my classes, there are people who are so comfortable within their bodies, but the darker parts of their bodies that they don't know of are the places in between these traditional classical shapes. I see a lot of shapes. I don't necessarily see movement. Back to my biggest lesson, I see these big achievements, right? These very defined geometry in the body. I don't necessarily see the appreciation of how they get there or how they get out of there. So I thought, how can I do that? And you know, it is really through play and through incorporating a little bit of the influence of dance and somatic practices into it. And when I say play, it can obviously sound very wishy-washy, like what the hell is play? Like, what do you mean? Do you just say just play? Like, that doesn't work, because that would scare people off. When I say play, it really means giving people tools to really play with their state of presence. So what is immediately around them, and what is it that they could use as ways to engage deeper within their present experience? And the example of this could be playing with the different kinds of sensations that they may feel. The two components that I use a lot are textural journeys through your sense of touch. What do you feel, you know, your skin as opposed to the mat, to your floor, to the wall, especially now when it's virtual classes, when you're in your own space. I also talk about visual journeys, so looking at patterns around you, colors around you, your drishti, right, a traditional practice of where your gaze is, and that in itself can already dramatically alter how you inhabit the present moment.
Hey guys, just a little break to let you know what I've been up to lately during this lockdown. I have created a space in my house where I can teach one-on-one yoga classes. In real life, no screens, no Zoom. just me and you, and a practice that is tailored to your needs. Whether that be an active or more restorative yoga practice, breathing exercises to balance your energy, or a yoga nidra for better sleep, we can talk about your specific needs and goals and work specifically on that together. So if that's something you're interested in, and if you live in Amsterdam, feel free to connect. You can find all my contact details on my website yeyoga.nl, and it's also linked in the description of this episode. Now back to my conversation with David. When we're talking about your classes and how you prepare your classes, is there, or build them rather, is there a structure? Is there a building to be built, or is it improvisation?
You know what, like through the years of teaching, I've been ping-ponging between like one to the other, to the other, to the other. And so I remember when I first started teaching, it's very much kind of a play of the traditional Ashtanga series. And then from there, adding what my teacher called daffodils. Daffodils being like the few fancy postures that you want to play with in every session, and then build your flow based on that. And beyond that, I started kind of playing even more as I gained confidence, and it became sort of a ladder flow. I don't know if you've practiced any sense of ladder flow before, but in case listeners have not heard of it before, ladder flows are when you build up one existing flow, perhaps a flow of five postures, and then adding another and another and another, becoming a flow of 10 postures. And it's quite a nice repetitive way of doing things and going further. And I've done that for quite a while, and I sort of enjoyed that, and that stayed with me for a long time. Because of the nature of my classes, they are very free. And when I say free, sometimes it can be a bit trickier for students to grasp, because they come in with an expectation of yoga being, okay, give me my few postures and I'm sorted, but I'm almost not giving them any shapes and just asking them to move. And by surprise, they may find themselves in a shape or another. And sometimes because of that, if I were to keep it too free, they would get lost. And so I realized that I need to be an anchor across it all. And the anchor can also be within the structure. So then this ladder flow type thing that I've been doing has allowed for kind of a sense of structure in them, so that they can simply tap into that meditative state, but with a little bit more guidance. But lately, you know, since COVID and since starting my virtual practices, I've been improvising. I've been I make sure that I have a starting point, and this is usually from words. I read a lot, especially this past year. And when I find a passage that is deeply resonant with me, I will use that as a place where we start, and then really tuning into the people who show up and seeing what they need. And then I go from there. And I have to say that this does come from experience. I don't think I would be confident enough to do that from the beginning. And I'm not saying one is better than the other as well. I think that's always gonna require a balance. And it's also kind of what we hope to achieve within our classes. So yeah, I guess right now, mainly I improvise, always from a starting point, but over time is always kind of a journey between going from structures to freeness and back to structure again. So that we're constantly surprised, you know. I don't believe in just one final way and that's it, because inevitably over time
that thing is going to get old, which means we're going to get stuck in a pattern, which then kind of means you're probably not playing anymore.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you mentioned that you started with more Ashtanga-like practices. And I'm curious to to hear when you made that shift and you started to move away from traditional linear yoga practices.
The shift kind of happened quite organically. It didn't... it wasn't really a conscious decision, because I know, like, a lot of the times I've been asked, like, oh, you know, your approach is unique, and would you like to trademark your thing, or like, is this a conscious business decision? And no. And to be honest, I feel like I'm a really, really poor business person. Like, in terms of my business model is rubbish, because what I stand for is that I encourage for my students to go away and learn from as many different teachers and as many different disciplines as they can. So I'm almost openly shooing them away if I see them too much. I'm like, great, I love seeing you here, but I hope that you're also doing other stuff. So yeah, not the greatest business model. So yeah, my lens has never been...
Why do you encourage them to explore other teachers and disciplines as well?
Sort of similar to why I allow my teaching style and the way I plan my teaching to keep changing. Because, I mean, I did say in the beginning that change is the only constant that we have. And if anything were to stay the same, things will get dull. There is, there's such contrasting sides to the coin here, because obviously in the traditional practice of yoga, you do the same thing again and again and again and again, so that you ease into that place of bliss. And that is absolutely an approach to do so. If your mind is, present enough to really catch yourself staying within the present. And within the traditional practice, what I can see happening there is to always keep yourself to the edge of your postures. So, like, not staying where you're most comfortable with, but going just a little bit further, which is why you see people, you know, going quite... I wouldn't say obsessed, but captivated by inversions or, you know, more challenging looking stuff, because it does help them tap into, like, oh gosh, I can't actually think about dinner or lunch and I have to be here. So that's an approach. Whereas from my end, I feel it's tricky. I definitely find myself coasting a lot, you know, if I were to keep myself being in the same place. So by changing things up, it really shifts your mind to a different thing. And what really helps me with this is a quote, again, that, you know, I hear from, I believe, the CTO of Microsoft. His name is Nathan Myhrvold, and he's so intelligent, one of the smartest person on earth, and that's why he's, like, you know, such a an influential person. And he is, I believe, like a chef, but also a paleontologist, like someone who studies dinosaur, but also a scientist and a data analyst or something like that. But it's just really, really crazy, diverse job scope. And he said, sometimes I find people studying more and more about less and less until they know nothing. And that is kind of like, say, if you're a doctor and you know everything about your thumb, but you kind of have lost sight of the entire hand. So then what is the point of that when you're so zoomed in? And so I guess, you know...
it's just this debate about being a generalist or a specialist, right?
Exactly, yeah. So then, whilst I don't discredit ways of practicing where you go, deeply in to one thing, I still have to argue that there is a need to shift to something else. Like, you can have a practice that you keep going back to every week, in or out, is going to be that. I think that's beneficial because it gives you a sense of anchoring, but still give yourself a chance once a week or something to play with another way of moving. Like, for I think over last year I've been playing with pole dancing, to trapezing, to back to dancing, to I don't know what else I've been, like animal flow kind of thing, you know, like it's just keep changing it up. And like, to your delight, I'm so sure, like pretty much 100% of the people who have approached this way of practicing come back stronger when they come back into their usual practice. And when I say stronger, not necessarily like, oh, I'm physically stronger, but they're just a lot more robust in the way they embrace challenges. So mental rigor.
Yeah. And also being a beginner again in something.
Yeah.
It's just so good for your mind. Like, I started following some kickboxing classes last year just to try something new and to be that beginner again.
Yes.
Because as a teacher, I think it's so important that you can also tap into a beginner's mind. And if you haven't been a beginner at something for a long time, it's quite hard to remember how that feels.
And it's very humbling.
So I noticed, I noticed that it really helped me as a yoga teacher to be a beginner in kickboxing, to then, connect more with beginners in my yoga classes.
Mm. And it's not even just adopting a beginner's mind again, but to simply allow someone else to hold you. You know, so many teachers whom I know, they have found a greater appreciation of being taught after taking the role of a teacher. And there's always a balance, like you said, you know, the importance of going back to having a beginner's mind. Why is that so important? And that's because, again, this zoom in thing, we can be very zoomed in as a teacher and get so bogged down by the technicalities of, oh, what we say, and oh, how effortless the flow is. But really, you know, when it comes to a beginner coming to class, they don't notice these things as much. They really just want to be held. And sometimes we get so much within the bubble of sophistication of, you know, how extra our flows need to be and how we present it, that we forget that we just need to do the basics. And I think of this as a binocular vision of being both a student and a teacher at the same time. Like, you as a teacher, you are a student of your students as your teachers too, if that makes sense. It's a simultaneous process. Yeah.
I want to go back in time to your childhood, because I believe you grew up in Malaysia, right?
Mm-hmm.
What was that like growing up there? And were you introduced to movement at a very young age? Or when did yoga or dance, I think dance came first, when did that enter your life?
I grew up in Malaysia and I loved it. I think it's really made me who I am. And, you know, a lot of the times when people compliment my offerings, I really attribute it to the way I've been brought up, because Malaysia is so multicultural that even when you speak the everyday lingo, you would hear a mishmash of English with Malay, with Tamil and Mandarin, like all mixed up together, because, you know, that's how we roll. And even with food, you know, there's so many different kinds. It's almost like a London in some way. And I think from there, I've learned to celebrate the fusion of elements from the very beginning. And when I say fusion of elements, the best way I can articulate this is how I see myself as an artist and not necessarily a dancer or an architect or a sculptor, because I'm an artist, so I would express myself however I need to, like with whatever medium I need. So if the way I have to express this one thing feels like it needs to be through movement, I will be a dancer then. If it needs to be expressed in space, maybe I'll be an architect. If it needs to be expressed in time, maybe I will become a musician. So it is that, and it's never, okay, this is me and this is only me. I am many things. So I'm really grateful for Malaysia for teaching me that. In terms of movement, I was not a mover. I really shied away from movement. And I remember the first time we were old enough to do running competitions, like really easy, like kind of a 6-year-old run, you know, in the school playground or something. When the teachers got me to run, I started crying because I just didn't want to. They had to call my mom to come and get me to run. I'm just not a mover. I was just not active physically at all. And there's many reasons for that. You know, I dealt with eczema from a really young age, and that got me very conscious in showing my skin. So I think with that, you know, sweating doesn't help eczema too, so I didn't like that. So then, yeah, movement was just nothing that I liked doing until I turned 12 or 13, when I was a kind of a senior in primary school. And then I got introduced to Chinese drums. And it's kind of like, you know, over Chinese New Year's, when you see lion dances and you see those drummers, essentially that. And since then, I've always been a musician. That was my starting point in art. And that's how I got roped in, because although it was very physical, it is inherently rhythmic. So it kind of tricked me into moving with, you know, playing the drums. It's quite highly physical. And since then, I realized that, oh, actually, I'm not bad at moving, which you sometimes think, right, when you suck at sports and we're like, oh, I can't even pass a ball, I can't even catch a ball. I suck at sports, so I suck at moving. It really is not, because then I realized from there that no, actually, I don't. I may not be the best at sports, but I actually enjoy moving, and I have relatively good fitness. So since, you know, I've been doing more and more until I found dance, and yoga actually started when just before I left to the UK to study. And I started that as a casual invitation to spend quality time with my mum, because we're really, really close, and I just wanted to spend more time with her before I left. So I thought, oh, well, why not yoga? Because there's a new yoga studio that just opened by our neighborhood. So we went, and yeah, that's how it all started. And then I came over to the UK, studied architecture, went into studying dance. And then yoga came back again as a way of me intensifying my dance training to maintain my dance health, I guess, more consistently, because performance is quite rigorous for the body. And to have yoga by the side has really helped me and my company really to stay on top of it through it all. And since I've been teaching.
What kind of dance were you doing?
So I studied contemporary dance in Trinity Laban Conservatoire. And within that degree, I did a master's degree, and that degree has elements of ballet as well, and a lot of improvisation, which is an element that I try to share in class as accessibly as I can.
Yeah. Going back to the way you teach, you already mentioned that you love reading books. And what I noticed is that your language is very creative.
Mm-hmm.
And it really spoke to me. And I just wonder how you developed that, the verbal cues and the analogies that you use and where you take your inspiration from.
Thank you, firstly, and I'm really glad it resonated with you. The inspiration always comes from my personal experience. And this is what I always share with teachers who ask me about how do you cue, like, what's the strategy? Personal experience. One of the best things that I started with my first teacher, who I did teacher training with, was that he sat us down with our manual, with our manual of postures on every page. And on every page, there were standard instructions. It was very classic, stand tall, big toes together, spine long, all of that. And then he got us to sit down and with every page, write down our own instructions. And it stayed with me in terms of how he got us to do it, which is to feel it within our body first and word it out like that. And I stick to the same thing. Obviously, I don't sit down and write this all down. And none of these cues I write down or I try to consciously remember. But this is when the rigor of your personal practice really pays off. When you expose yourself to long hours of practicing and deep practicing and different ways of accessing movement, different angles of accessing postures, you find different ways of feeling every moment. And a lot of the things that I say in my class, the cues that I give, are what I see in my mind when I move. And I really believe this is why it resonated with you, because it came from me. It could have been something that I read of somewhere, and I am so confident that you would be able to tell the difference, because there's what's missing is an element of embodied truth. I haven't lived in it. And this is why another big thing that constantly come up at this stage of my teaching is, are you not bothered by these younger teachers stealing your words or stealing your flow and doing your thing? And I'm actually no. Firstly, I take it as flattery. Thank you. And I hope that you've credited me. But if not, that's your journey. But still, I'm not worried or offended anyway, because that's them making sense of things themselves. And I trust that whatever comes from me comes from my truth. And if I were to do the same in, say, going to your class and hearing your words and using your words, if I haven't actually lived it, I wouldn't have been convincing. And so it's really that. If you don't trust what you're saying, if you've not felt what you're saying, don't say it. Just leave it out. Actually, silence would have been even more helpful for your student than to kind of blab around the words, because it becomes too much, and it's down to this concept of essentialism, right? Of minimalism, how you can give space. And that's really the art of where teaching lies over time, when you know to give space And when you know to not overfeed as well, which is something I love doing in the beginning, you know, give, that is almost like every student of yours have a silver spoon. And when you take away that spoon, they feel lost, but not because they can't get out of it. They just got too used to being so comfortably within your embrace. And can you just let them fall a little bit and see how they pick themselves up? And you'd be surprised by how responsive everyone gets when you just allow them to cry a little bit, you know, like kids.
Yeah, that's so true. I've noticed that with guided meditations as well.
Mm-hmm.
Like there's some people that that will guide you through a meditation and they'll just be talking. And they say beautiful words, but I prefer them to leave a bit of quietness as well in between the words so I can marinate in that sense of language and, yeah, just give it some time to land or something. Mm-hmm. And it's the same with a movement practice, I reckon.
Absolutely.
The words push you into the experience, but at some point you have to, like, yeah, just be with yourself and in silence as well.
Mm-hmm. With any practices, really, like, you know, even when I'm in a traditional academic setting, even in a lecture, the most impactful lecture I've had in universities are when the words are dropped and I'm still thinking about it. And 5 years later, they land and they're just like, whoa, like, I just got what my lecturer said, and that was so powerful. And it is that, you know, just kind of dropping little hints for people to make sense of it themselves, letting people complete the picture and not like
mm-hmm.
painting everything for them and just let them see the finished thing. Because then the person is just receiving and not connecting the dots, which is a really important part of the process too.
Yeah, true. Mm. I wonder what your self-practice looks like and if that's a daily thing for you.
Yeah, it's very varied, I think. And I want to come very clear and honest about this as well. Since the very beginning of my like teacher training, I got very overwhelmed by how, you know, you get told, okay, so now that you are off and certified, the prerequisite is that you have to practice your Ashtanga series every single day, except for Sunday, and you know, do that for an hour or so every day. And from day one, I couldn't keep it. I just couldn't. And it just didn't feel right. It just felt too fixed for me. And I know a lot of...
You mean you couldn't stick to the Ashtanga sequence or just the rhythm of doing the same thing every day?
Yes, that. Yeah, I find that really tricky. And honestly, I have so much respect for those practitioners who are able to commit. Because again, there is a way of discipline in itself. But I guess what I want to really emphasize on is there's no one way. Like, this is what I really want to focus on. There is no one way to do anything. And in the past, when I wasn't able to commit to that kind of practice, that approach, I felt bad. I felt like, oh gosh, I'm such a bad teacher and I didn't do what was meant to be done. And I'd like to sort of not redefine it, but perhaps allow us all to rediscover what the essence of what is said could mean. So why did they say, oh, do the Ashtanga series every single day except for Sunday? And if we really break it down, it's essentially saying, make sure you spend time with yourself every day, you know. And the rest day is also important, because like, except for Sunday, it really means give yourself some time off. Yeah, like that was just a suggested structure. But then how do you want to take it? Right now, for me, I have to say, the time I spend is always varied, especially before COVID when I'm on the go all the time. There is just no way I could fit like an hour's practice. So it would be 20 minutes for me of wiggling, not even any yoga postures. That's all too structured and defined for me. I like doing those things in class. I would attend a class to do it when I feel like it. But if it's just me, myself, I just want to be rolling around on the floor and that's it. Like, and there's no skills or technique required. It literally is the same feeling of when I just wake up in bed and when I give myself a nice stretch. I didn't think about that. It was just, I kind of want to go here, so let me go here. I've been really enjoying restorative practices, so I've been spending lots of times with my weighted blanket and just, and that's it. Because again, right, like I need to connect with myself. That's all. That's the only statement that I keep to. And connecting could be, today I just really want to move because I feel sluggish. The next day, I'm so distracted. I just want to center. So let me just stay with my blanket here. And also, practice being something that feeds and nourishes your soul. So it may not even be either. Sometimes I play the piano. I do singing classes because that's also a part of movement. I've been really into plants at the moment. So that's also another way. And I guess if there's one thing that I could commit to, it would be waking up every morning and the first thing I do being walking around my home, looking at my plants. That in itself is my meditation. Just looking at my plants, seeing the changes that they make every day, done, you know? But essentially, I guess how I'd love to summarize this is I go by my desire. I go by my impulse. And this is something that I feel, have mostly forgotten because as adults, we get layered on these ideas of I should be doing this or I need to do this. We forget the I want. And I want this this time to connect with myself to be something that comes purely from a place of desire. Not that I kind of need to connect with myself because I haven't done it today, but I want to. So what do I want to do today? And it could be, I want to sing my heart out. So I'll do that. And then the next day, I want to scribble and draw. I'll do that. So that's my practice.
Mm.
If that makes sense.
And then, totally, yes, for sure. Mm. I can imagine that some people might think, okay, but I have this goal, I want to be able to do a handstand or something. And then it takes many, many hours, many months of practice to nail that handstand for most of us. There may be some natural gymnasts out there who can easily do it. And then the approach of just waking up and, oh, I'm just going to do what I feel like, doesn't really work, right? And I know that you are able to do quite some challenging gymnastic like tricks. How was your journey to achieve those goals?
I love speaking about this one actually because it's a really meaningful journey for me personally. Because I was deeply fearful of inversions, deeply. Firstly, because as a dancer and as someone who has a relatively mobile lower back, I tend to banana all the time. Mm. And as a dancer as well, I get very paranoid about unnecessarily injuring myself because it's my livelihood. I can injure myself as a teacher. I can still teach with my mouth, but I can't dance if I nick anything, and it's to a level where I would not go skiing, or you know, when I kind of slip over a banana, I'm like, oh my gosh, am I okay? You know, it's that place of paranoia at that point in life. So when it came to inversion, I went through so many cycles of awareness. The first one being why the hell do I want to do it? You know, I think a lot of the times it becomes almost an achievement that we parade around, and then I remind myself, okay, I am worth it, and like whether or not I get my handstand is not really gonna make me a better person. So that gone, like that one thought is off. The other, and then when I go deeper, why is this something that I need to look into? And this is where the work of yoga begins. Because I'm sensing such a deeply rooted fear in losing control. To this day, I am scared of water, so swimming is tricky for me. I will still need to do a few laps of very slow, breath-focused swimming before I can then enter without that, you know, fear of like, gosh, you know, I'm gonna drown or whatever. So that's been ingrained in me. And I was thinking, okay, what is the similarity between this? My feet couldn't touch the ground, you know? So that's why it's a bit of like a, oh gosh, like I'm not able to control my body fully. Where am I going to go? So then, okay, I just very clearly made a decision. I'm going to work on this. And the way I worked on it is literally every single time my teachers got me to... like ask us to go into an inversion, I give myself a try based on how I feel. There will be days, even to this day, now that I can do it consistently, I still freak out. And if I freak out, I just don't do it, or I do a modification of it. There are technical modifications that we can do, but I'm not going to go into this here because, I mean, we're simply listening and that's more within a workshop. But first thing is to really like sense your state of mind. The second thing I do is before I teach every class, I would literally handstand myself across the room. And that's because I know at least within my body, I can physically do it. My block is mentally, from the mental aspect, right? Because I said I was fearful. But I have the physical facility to get myself up. I have the strength in my arms. I just don't have the awareness in my center yet, perhaps, and maybe the legs. So I just let myself go through the entire room doing handstands, and they're not for perfection. Like probably 70% of these handstands were like crappy, I fall down kind of handstands. But it's just for me to mentally get myself there, to show myself that, okay, I fall, I don't die. Literally just that. So that I would take myself more lightly. And then from there, beyond that, I have to say, I've not done any like, I've not put myself into, okay, every day I'm going to have to do these handstand drills. None of that for me. I just stayed with my practice. At that point, I did a lot of yoga classes and I really paid attention to every single detail that my teachers share. And say specifically within my journey towards pressing up to a handstand, I didn't do any pressing drills. What I really worked on was my lunge. And from my lunge, all of a sudden one day, when I was given the opportunity to try pressing as a transition, it just went, oh, it just happened because my body clicked into place. And this is where it's very interesting when it comes to the way your body develops. I don't want to say that, oh my gosh, it's going to happen magically for all of you there. I know in my body, which is the only body I can speak from, that I am blessed with strength and physical facility already from my dance training. But my mind wasn't there. And so when I really tune into all the specific stuff that was put into every other kinds of movement, my body naturally became ready for what I wish to do. The same thing as when I studied the thumb so much, yeah, these handstand drills, so much, I forget what it means to just move the entire hand. And so when I just let myself work on everything else, things fall into place. And this is why when it comes to cueing as well, right, as teachers, if there are teachers who are listening, this is why we don't need to cue 50 billion things. Because yes, when you try to cue for one posture, you can see that there's so many things you need to say, right? Oh, where do you look? What do your shoulders do? Your neck? What does your ankle do? Your knee? Your hips? So many things. But sometimes just picking one cue, the entire rest of the body falls into place. And you're selectively picking one. And it's the same angle. So all I did was I stayed with my practice. I really focused on every single moment of the practice instead of coasting through it all. And oh, it's inversion time. I'm going to focus on inversion. Like, forget about that. Just ride through the whole class with the most like rigorous kind of way of listening of what the teachers are actually saying. And then things really will just manifest from the body. Yes, I'm not arguing that, you know, that if you do drills, it wouldn't help. It really does. But how do these drills help? They help because they allow you to tap into a place in your body which you can then recognize and remember. That's all. You go into those places so you can remember how that feels. And so then when you do it, you can be like, oh, actually, does that feel similar to that? Or does that not feel similar to that? And then, you know, things just happen. And, you know, last year I watched this baby's documentary thing on Netflix, which is so mind-blowing. And I know, you know, we can't see it because we're on a podcast, but I can try and visually describe it to you. They were trying to chart out the growth progress of babies physically, and when they measure the height of the baby, they could see that growth progresses not in a diagonal line, smooth kind of way, like the slope of a mountain, but it's actually flat lines over a few days, and then after 2 or 3 days, a sudden hike, a sudden increase in height. And then flatlining again, and a sudden increase in height. So it literally looks like a bar chart, you know, where it's like height 2 cm, and then the next 4 days it will be 2 cm stagnant, and then after the fifth day it's suddenly 5 cm, and then 6 cm, and then 9 cm. It's like that. And this is why, you know, a lot of the times, especially advanced practitioners, we talk about stagnancy, right? Like, oh, I've hit the wall. I'm not improving. I'm here for 10 years. And you feel like that. And that's what I mean. Like, there's never any sense of linear. And sometimes you regress. Sometimes you feel like, gosh, I did that yesterday. Why can't I be anywhere close to that today? And it's because the body keeps changing. And again, back to listening, right? Listening. Where's my body today? How can I manage through this to get there? Same thing with what I said about fear. Today I feel really, really scared of going upside down. Tomorrow I may feel like I'm at the top of the world and I can do anything.
Yeah, it's so true. We wake up different every day.
Absolutely.
Just coming back to where we started, like, the only constant is change.
Yeah.
What makes a great teacher?
Yeah, so many angles to this. I'm going to share in a metaphoric way because I think it's the easiest way to articulate myself right now. And that would be that a teacher is more like a gardener than an architect. And what I mean by that is you sow the seeds, you plant the seeds, and you allow the growth to happen within your students on their own. Like, you don't know what's going to happen. One tree may be a huge apple tree. The other tree may not flourish as much, but you continue to tend to it. You continue to water it. And what I mean by architect is coming in with a really clear vision and not diverging from it. Because the students you get every day change. You change as a teacher as well. And so if you're able to tap into this state of mind of a gardener and to simply focus on the present in tending to, nurturing, without expectations, I think that's what makes a great teacher.
Yeah, I love that. Which teacher, or it can be more than one, inspire you the most?
Wow, yeah, this is a tricky one to... so many. Are we talking specifically within yoga or my teachers in life?
Can be teachers in life.
My greatest... one of the most influential teachers in my life is called Rosemary Brandt, and she's actually a dance teacher of mine. And what I loved about her is the level of restraint that she shows because of how much she believes in each and every one of her students. And when I say restraint, is that fishing rod thing, you know, like giving you the rod and you have to really go and fish it without giving you the fish that much. And by the end of that, the reward of being able to get to where you have, through all that you've learned, is just so many folds, you know. And that's what I really appreciated from her, even in the way that she structures her exam, you know, where we get elements of and tools of how we can approach something, and then being allowed to just run with it. I found it so inspiring. But I guess in short, the restraint, knowing, trusting her students enough to not give too much of what she already knows and not project what she already knows, and encouraging us to find our own answers and only dropping hints here and there as points of departures, and not definitive, finalized answers. So, in short, a teacher that allows, that leaves you with more questions than answers. That's what I valued from her.
That's beautiful. I'm having a look at the clock, and I think we're going to wrap up our conversation with some rapid-fire questions.
Sure.
First question, what's the best advice someone ever gave to you?
So what? Now what?
Who was that?
So what? And now what? And that's from Linda Clyde Wayman. She is, I believe, a headmistress of a school somewhere in the world. I forgot, but she's I believe she's a TED speaker, TED Women's speaker. You will be able to find her there, Linda Clyde Wayman. And yeah, I like that because it's teaching us to not be too attached to both our successes as well as our failures. You are at the highest point of your life right now. So what? What now? You are at the lowest point. So what? But what now? Yeah.
What advice do you have for yoga teachers or movement teachers that are just starting their teaching career and that are listening right now to this podcast?
Remember why you teach.
Which book should be on everyone's bookshelf?
One of my recent favorites is Dancing with the Gods by Kent Nerburn, and it's him writing an open letter on life, living life as a creative, as an artist, and there's many things in there that are just really beautiful gems of wisdom.
Nice. I haven't heard of that one. I'm gonna check it out for sure.
Mm.
And who or what inspires you the most?
Who or what inspires? Right now, my baby niece. She inspires me to play all the time and to allow myself to make mistakes and fall as she's learning how to walk right now, and just seeing how gracefully she comes up and down the floor. The ease in her reminds me to find ease in my life too, you know, not forcing things through and just allow things to flow. So my niece.
That's beautiful. What are you most grateful for today?
Grateful. I'm grateful for space to connect to through words. I always find conversations being the most insightful, not even just by being prompted to speak or to share, but speaking is a way for me to make sense of myself too. So thank you for giving me this opportunity to do that.
Well, it's my pleasure. Talking about speaking, who do you think I should speak to next on this podcast?
Oh, lots. Out of the top of my head, I would say someone called Dav Jones. He's a dear brother of mine, Dav Jones. I don't know if you've heard of him before. He is actually based in Doha. And I love him because he's such a humble practitioner. He's very acrobatic, but someone who, in my personal opinion, someone who embodies eternal studentship. He's always learning, always humble, but still always so generous in sharing. So I believe he would be able to bring an interesting approach and mix to all that you already offer with your previous guests.
Cool. I haven't heard of him, but I'm sure I can find him somewhere on the internet.
Yes, yeah.
Okay.
Otherwise, let me know and I'm happy to connect to you both together because he is a gem.
Nice. Thank you so much. Is there anything you want to add to this conversation?
Well, I guess I'd love to just gift us with a quote that I always stick to. And this quote is something I always share in all my interviews as well, actually. So it says, "The creative poverty of not yet knowing is an invitation to play." I'm going to repeat this. "The creative poverty of not yet knowing is an invitation to play." And what that means basically is a reminder for me personally to not be overwhelmed by not knowing enough, especially as an adult, and allow the fact that I don't know enough to be something that motivates me towards continuing to play and imagine and discover and wonder.
Yes, that's a beautiful quote. Who are recording here?
This one I actually don't know. I couldn't find it for the life of me. It was just a magical encounter of these words on a website, which I just couldn't quite find again, but it stayed with me for so long.
Yes.
But once I find it, I'll let you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's definitely not my own words. That for sure I could say it's not my own words, but one that has stayed with me for a long time. And if anyone finds who this is from, let me know.
Beautiful. Thank you so much. If people want to reach out or know more about you, where should they go? Is that your Instagram and your website?
Yeah, I think the best way for you to reach out to me in the most intimate way would be through Instagram. You can find me at David Kam KW. So that's David Kam KMKW. And through the links in my bio, you'll have access to my regular classes as well as my actual website as well, where you can read more about me and more about what I have been up to. At the moment, I only offer one open class on Sunday mornings. Obviously London time, but this year will see me offering a little bit more in the coming months, so stay tuned.
Nice, looking forward to seeing that. Yeah, thank you so much for taking the time for this conversation, and yeah, I'll be following your journey online.
Thank you, and thanks for having me again.
And that's it for today's episode. Thank you so much for listening until the end. If you liked it, hit that subscribe button on your app, leave a review, give me a 5-star rating. I definitely appreciate all the little support that I get. Also, if you wanna practice with me online, you can find my online Zoom schedule on my Instagram or on my website. So that's yeyoga.nl/schedule. I'll see you next time, and thanks again so much for tuning in.